first hear from Mr. Smith.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Paul Smith, and I have the privilege of representing Elizabeth Cornell. Mrs. Cornell would have wanted to be here in court in front of Your Honors. Unfortunately, that was not possible, but she is attending via remote. I'd like to point out to the court that the state and the lower court's inescapable logic leads to a absurd conclusion, which is no, as long as a parole is suspended, the parolee can be arrested at any time in the future, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, it doesn't matter, because as long as the state drops the revocation proceedings against the parolee, then there's no harm. And I believe that can't be the case. That can't be correct.
Just back up. I think we're arguing on two different tracks. The first is, you know, can it be executed 7 years late? And that seems to, you have a decent argument that that's precluded under state law, and it seems like that's what happened here. But now you've asserted a Section 1983 claim, and that seems like there's a different question about whether that violates the Constitution. So can you help us understand why that violates the Constitution? It may well violate state law.
Thank you, Your Honor. And we believe there were genuine issues of material fact that it violated state law, and also that it violated the Constitution. The Constitution imposes a reasonableness requirement in the use of force and arrest situations, and to execute a warrant 7 years late on a, or 7 years later on a parolee, we believe was unreasonable under the Constitution.
What's your case law for that? I mean, first of all, is this clearly established? Because right now we have an assertion of qualified immunity. It's unclear exactly how this is coming up to us, because the district court seemed to rule on the merits of the constitutional question and said this just wasn't a constitutional violation. But assuming it was a constitutional violation, what's your case law for why that was clearly established, that a search warrant could not be issued 7 years after the fact?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Executed 7 years after the fact.
Thank you, Your Honor. We would rely on the McCowan versus Nelson opinion, which we've cited in our brief, which stands for the proposition that failure to exercise reasonable diligence in exercising a arrest warrant on a parolee results in a waiver of the violation and of jurisdiction.
So
I'd also point out,
help me understand that one. What's your argument for why there was no reasonable diligence here? Because your client gave an address and a contact number, and is there any dispute that they tried to find her using that information and were unable to do so?
Yes, there is, Your Honor. We disputed below that there was any personal knowledge of any effort by the HPA, paroling authority, to contact or locate Ms. Cornell. The sole evidence that's presented to this court and to the district court below by the HPA that they made any effort to contact Elizabeth Cornell was at SER 11, submitted by the state. And it's a declaration of a Tommy Johns, who was an administrator. He has no personal knowledge for any of the three paragraphs in his declaration at 8, 9, and 10, where he says the HPA tried to contact Ms. Cornell at the phone number provided. HPA tried to reach her by mail at a P.O. box provided. The mail was returned undeliverable, and the HPA conducted a field visit as provided, but she was no longer living there. If these facts were correct, first of all, he doesn't have personal knowledge of this. He just says the HPA did it. But where is the phone number that they called? Where is the return letter that supposedly came back to the HPA? None of those things have been provided. Where is the name of the individual who went to see Ms. Cornell supposedly and she wasn't living there? there are genuine issues of material fact, which Ms. Cornell raises, that none of these things occurred. However, we objected below to the declaration of Tommy John that he did not have personal knowledge to attest that any of those steps were actually taken. And had, for example, a letter been sent and returned, that should have been kept by the paroling authority as part of Ms. Cornell's file and then attached to the court to show that they did something. But counsel, they did nothing.
Counsel.
Sorry, Your Honor.
Let's turn to the actual execution of the warrant. When it was executed, wasn't your client offered an opportunity for a prompt hearing? And didn't she waive it?
That's correct, Your Honor. She was offered a prompt hearing. And Your Honor, I believe, is correct regarding her waiver that she wanted a full hearing.
And when she was accorded a hearing sometime later.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Yes. She prevailed.
That is correct, Your Honor. They dismissed all the charges. I believe they found that they were stale, and they retroactively reinstated her prior.
Does the reason matter?
I think it does, Your Honor. Because
those reasons existed, those reasons existed factually at the time she was picked up, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. The staleness of the warrant existed when she was picked up, and I believe that was the grounds why the HPA dismissed her the parole as to her, because it had been so long and she had not committed any crime, and she had lived openly and obviously in the state of Hawaii, and then her parole was retroactively discharged. That's correct, Your Honor. But it seems futile to arrest someone years and years after an infraction only to then discharge the entirety of the parole, where had there been some diligence exercised by the HPA, the entire arrest could have been averted. And I believe that under the Constitution, the reasonableness requirement was not met here, given the delay and given the McCowan case, which says that parole warrants need to be exercised with reasonable diligence. As the court knows, in McCowan, the state of California was unable to exercise a parole retake warrant as the parolee was incarcerated in Arizona on another offense. They actually did take reasonable steps to try to locate the parolee, but they couldn't extradite the parolee to California until he finished his Arizona sentence. It's a very different circumstance here.
Counsel, I'm struggling with your argument a little bit, because given the nature of the parole violation at issue here, which is failing to stay in contact with the parole authority, I mean, you're focusing a lot on what the officers or what law enforcement should have done to be reasonably diligent. And it strikes me that this whole problem would have gone away if your client had been reasonably diligent in her obligations and just gone to the parole authority and said, I now have new location, instead of relying on a letter. Shouldn't we factor that into this in terms of, I mean, I'm aware of the case that you cite about the standard is reasonable diligence. We as a court have never defined what that means. And doesn't your client have some role to play here when the nature of this violation was entirely within her control?
And Your Honor makes a very fair argument. I would submit that there were genuine issues of material fact on this precise point. And Your Honor raises a valid point that perhaps Ms. Cornell could have taken further steps. I would submit to Your Honor that she had been rendered homeless.
She moved, right? Isn't it clear that she moved? The address that she gave 7 years prior was not the only address she'd been at. Do you know how many other addresses she'd been at in the meantime?
Two, Your Honor.
Okay. And were
two
either
other
of those,
addresses.
Were either of those ever given to the parole department?
There's no indication in the record that those were actually supplied to the parole board. There is a explanation that is in the record, which was that Ms. Cornell was informed by her parole officer that the parole officer was requesting her discharge from parole. And so Ms. Cornell, rightly or wrongly, relied on that information and understood, having not heard anything from the HPA for years that she had been discharged from her parole. And so perhaps she could have done more. I could see that point of view, but I would submit to your honors that she did enough. And
well,
her letter, which
you keep couching it as she could have done more, but there's really no dispute that she didn't give updated information when she moved. I mean, you couch
I believe
this
that
as
there,
factual
that wasn't
disputes, but where yeah. is the factual dispute? She didn't give it.
Your Honor.
Go ahead.
She did. She gave alternate information of her address at that time when she was made homeless, and she gave a phone number where she could be reached and a mailing address where her mail could be delivered. And we would submit that there are genuine issues of material fact whether the state checked on any of those three sources of information whatsoever. The only evidence in the record is a lack of personal knowledge declaration of a Mr. Tommy Johns, who has no personal knowledge that any of those steps were taken. And so we would submit under the Cowan case and also the United States versus Sanchez, which also reiterates that and it's cited by the state of Hawaii in their brief, but Sanchez reiterates that when a parole arrest warrant is delayed, that there can be a waiver, that can effect a waiver, particularly here where we're dealing with just a minor infraction. I would posit to the court that the government's interest in retaking Ms. Cornell, who had been on parole for 4 years, was minimal, particularly as she hadn't committed any crime. She had just become homeless. And so one other factor I think to take into account regarding Ms. Cornell's not contacting the state is that for 3 years, she was arrested 3 years after her maximum sentence had expired. So she really had no reason to think that she was still under the parole jurisdiction. She needed to contact her parole board because of the length and period of time that had elapsed. And unlike McCowan, she wasn't trying to avoid service of a retake warrant or trying to hide from parole. She just thought she had been discharged from parole.
So counsel,
right?
We're in appellate court, right? And you're making a constitutional argument focused on delay and saying that at some point due process says a delay is too long. How would you have us write that rule? Is it 6 months? Is it a year? Is it 3 years? You know, how do we do this when your argument is solely delay?
Yes, Your Honor. I think there's a point in time. One of the prior Supreme Court justices said, "I know it when I see it." I mean, it's 7 years is too long. Had we been dealing with 4 years in McCowan, the court said 4 years could be too long, except the state of California had undertaken efforts to try to locate the individual. And so the Ninth Circuit there had said that was not an inordinate delay because of the circumstances. And so what we would submit to the court is that the circumstances here were different. She wasn't hiding. She was living openly and notoriously. And there appears to have been nothing done by the state, particularly if the court was to discount the lack of personal knowledge declaration of Mr. Johns, because there is no evidence that they actually did the things he claims they did where he didn't have personal knowledge of it.
So
the only thing that was
undertaken. I don't understand that argument in terms of his declaration, because he says at the beginning of his declaration that he reviewed, he made the statements he made about what the parole authority had done based on a review of the records of the parole authority, and that he has personal knowledge of the record keeping system. He personally reviewed them, and he can recount to the court what they contain. I mean, that's standard practice in litigation. So why is that invalid?
There is no evidence of a letter actually having been sent out or returned. Where is the letter? There's no name of any person who actually went out to see if they could find Ms. Cornell. I would submit to your honors that there's, if those things were in fact correct that he claims were done, and he's claiming these things 7 years after the fact, that there should be something in Ms. Cornell's file that those steps were taken, as opposed to just an administrator later writing up a declaration saying he did, that these things were done. We don't have evidence. That's my response, Your Honor. I think there were genuine issues of material fact on these points, and we did make those objection to his declaration at ER 81 and 82 of the record.
Okay, we'll give you some time for rebuttal. We'll give you a couple of minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And now we'll hear from Mr. Awong.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is William Awong, and I represent the defendant appellant in this case, the Hawaii Paroling Authority, which more accurately would be the state of Hawaii, and Sheriff Dexter Kauahi. In this case, plaintiff was required by the terms and conditions of her parole to affirmatively keep the authorities apprised of her whereabouts, and she failed to do so.
Well, she now, hold on. Initially, she gave some information, and I guess let's just jump into this Mr. Johns affidavit. Was Mr. Johns giving inaccurate information in his affidavit or declaration about the records that he reviewed in the files?
Yes, Your Honor. His name was Tommy Johnson. He was the the Hawaii Paroling Authority. But for convenience, I'll start using HPA administrator. And as the court has already mentioned, he, as the administrator, had access and knowledge of how the records are kept, and he reviewed those records to determine what had happened. It is also inaccurate to say that that is the only evidence of those attempts. On the supplemental record that,
but
the
can,
state
can I
submitted,
just follow up on that? If this were to go,
yes,
to,
sure.
If this were to go to discovery and opposing counsel were trying to get copies of letters, do those letters exist, or the return letter, does that exist in the file? Do you have any information or knowledge about that?
Your Honor, I have no information about whether, to be honest, I would be surprised, but I don't have information about whether a returned mail envelope from 2011 is still in the possession of the file.
But there would at least be a notation that it was sent out and returned, or what is Mr. Johnson's basis for his declaration? Is he just saying this would have been standard procedures, and so we know that this was done, or is there some notation in the file that this was done?
My understanding, Your Honor, is that this was from his review of the record. So, I mean, although it's not explicitly stated, I believe the unavoidable inference is that there was some record in the file that gave him this information.
Okay.
I think just as in addition to that, as kind of corroboration of this, is SER 31, in which that's the notice of hearing and the rights for revocation hearing given to Ms. Cornell after her arrest. And in the supporting evidence indicates there is a letter on file, which was her March 1st, 2011 letter. And it also indicates that the subject reported a P.O. box number, and that the probation officer attempted to mail a letter, but it was received back as undeliverable on May 2nd, 2011. A subsequent field visit was done on May 10th, 2011 by that PO to address whether or not Ms. Cornell could be located at the given information, and she was not. So while there are other corroborating documents in the record before the court, I think it would have been sufficient, even if that were the case, that it was only Mr. Johnson's declaration that he had reviewed the records and that they accurately indicated that those efforts had been undertaken and that those contact information was invalid.
Does the state of Hawaii have a position on what constitutes a reasonable length of time for the validity of a warrant of this type?
Your Honor, I think as the
you could start with a yes or you could start with a yes or no.
I guess yes, there is a position, and that position is that there should be no, and there is no definite time period by which a warrant should or does automatically stale. Now, admittedly,
how about 10 years?
Again, Your Honor, it's all under that reasonableness assessment, and so 10 years is not per se make that warrant invalid. It still requires a determination of why such a long time could have possibly been reasonable.
How about 10 years after the expiration of the maximum sentence she would have served without parole?
I understand that the court is taking it to an extreme, but even at that point, yes, I could come up with circumstances where 10 years after the expiration of her parole would in some case still be reasonable. For instance, if it was undisputed that plaintiff had left the country or was actively avoiding service of any kind of warrant in another country, in those cases, yes, even 10 years after the expiration of her maximum parole date could have been or could be interpreted as reasonable under the circumstances.
Okay, so when you say reasonable, are we talking about under the Hawaii law, or are we talking about under the U.S. Constitution?
Specifically, I was talking about the U.S. Constitution, Your Honor, but as the court below noted, the analysis is a similar one under the Hawaii law.
So even do you think we should look to Hawaii? Hold on. Do you think we should look to Hawaii law in interpreting the Constitution here as to reasonableness?
No, Your Honor, I do not.
Okay. Well, because, I mean, Hawaii, as I read State versus Owens, the 2007 decision, Hawaii, at least the Supreme Court in that particular case, said a five-year delay was too much. So it sounds like there's probably precedent here that this was unreasonable under state law. The question is, how much does that transfer over into the federal constitution?
Well, I think, Your Honor, first of all, to speak to Owens, you know, the language that Owens is evaluating is the language under Hawaii Rules of Penal Procedure 9 that requires due diligence in the service of a warrant. And although that language is not identical, obviously, to a reasonableness language, due diligence in that case is another way of saying that they need to have exercised reasonable due diligence in order to serve that warrant. And in Owens, that case was 5 years, but that was never indicated to be a bright letter line that 5 years or that any amount of time is a bright letter line or a black and white line about what is due diligence and what is unreasonable.
Can I, on the factual side, do we know or does the record tell us whether Ms. Cornell had a specific individual assigned as her parole officer?
I don't believe that is in the record. I mean, she would have always been assigned a parole officer, but I don't think it is. In actuality, I don't think she had only one, and in the record, I don't think it is established that she had only one.
Thank you.
And what evidence is in the record that she updated the parole board when she moved initially? Is there any evidence in the record about attempts that she made when she moved subsequent to that to update them?
Yes, Your Honor. In her own declaration, in the complaint, the record is replete with the acknowledgement that she made no further efforts to contact the paroling authority. Now, whether that was based on her belief that she had been discharged or not, the underlying fact is not reasonably disputed. She made no further attempts to contact the Hawaii Paroling Authority.
Counsel, are you aware of any case law that has said that a delay violates due process when there has been no evidence of prejudice to the defendant or the parolee?
No, Your Honor. I think, as the court accurately points out, I think it's kind of two different questions. There's the Fourth Amendment question, and there's the 14th due process. But as far as I'm aware, there is no case that says there's a due process violation when she is not prejudiced by the delay, or when, I'm sorry, a defendant is not prejudiced by the delay. I think to kind of keep going with that analogy is, or not analogy, but that analysis is appellant statement that it leads to an absurd result. And I think that's inaccurate because, it's inaccurate because the requirement for prejudice is only a substantive, is only the analysis under the 14th Amendment substantive due process. I'm sorry, procedural due process. So a delay may still be a constitutional violation for which there is a remedy, but that would be provided under the Fourth Amendment. So to simply say that in every case where there is no prejudice from the delay, namely that the that defendant prevailed in a subsequent parole hearing, is not the only way by which a potential defendant can or should, or the court should analyze whether or not there was damages or whether or not there was a constitutional violation. It is only with respect to the procedural due process that there can be no violation where there was no prejudice.
As to the state claims, can you speak to those a little bit? Is there this qualified privilege, does that, in your opinion, cover all of the state claims, or do we need to parse that out a little more carefully?
Your Honor, I think it covers all of the state claims with respect to Sheriff Kawahi. Qualified privilege is, it's entitled to, and I, even more so, Sheriff Kawahi in his individual capacity. Qualified immunity is, or non-judicial government officials are entitled to qualified immunity in their individual capacities, absent a showing that they acted with malice or for an improper purpose. So that does resolve the state's claims, I mean, Sheriff Kawahi's claims in his individual capacity under tort law. Now, it has also resolved It doesn't resolve the intentional or because that requires a showing of, you know, this outrageous conduct. And it doesn't resolve false imprisonment with respect to Sheriff Kawahi. But as indicated in the analysis under the Fourth Amendment, that the underlying arrest was not violative of the law in the first place. So there is no tort violation for false arrest or imprisonment with respect to Sheriff Kawahi in his individual capacity. With respect to the state and the official capacity claims, it's a slightly different argument dealing with sovereign immunity, but I don't believe that was the court's question. So unless the court wants me to go into it, I'll stop there.
No, that's helpful. I mean, the bottom line is, I think we are only looking to qualified privilege as it relates to the sheriff and the claims against the sheriff in the individual capacity. And that my question was, I think you answered it, whether qualified privilege applies to all of these claims. And you're saying
and no,
you don't
Your
think
Honor.
It does as to false imprisonment.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
You know, I guess we've talked largely about whether the constitutional rights were violated. I think one thing that we haven't addressed or that I'd point out to the court's attention is that the Hawaii Parole Authority, as well as the state, since it is an agency of the state of Hawaii, and Sheriff Kawahi in his official capacity are not subject to suits under Section 1983. Now, plaintiff has indicated that there's some kind of workaround to this based on the Ex parte Young doctrine, but Ex parte Young is in relation to 11th Amendment and sovereign immunity, and the state did not raise below, and the court below did not rule that there's any kind of 11th Amendment issue. The relative issue, or the relevant issue, excuse me, was that the state and official capacity defendants are not persons amenable to suit under 1983, except in the limited case for prospective injunctive relief. In that case, the court below accurately cited the law that's not relevant here because she is no longer on parole. She is no longer subject to such an arrest, to a parole retake warrant, and she's no longer under the custody, constructive or otherwise, of the paroling authority. So she has no ability to or standing to make such a claim for relief. To the extent that appellant also references a similar doctrine under Ex parte Young, that prospective injunctive relief would be permissible. Again, it's not applicable because that's not the case here. But in addition to that, the same analysis would apply, that this is, she's not entitled to prospective injunctive relief. I see my time is just about clicking to zero, so unless the court has any further questions, I have nothing further to say, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. We'll give 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Briefly, regarding the lower court in finding there was no Fourth Amendment violation, relied on a Hawaii Revised Statutes 353-66 and saying that because Ms. Cornell's parole had been suspended, there could be no Fourth Amendment violation. So the lower court actually relied on state statute to find there was no Fourth Amendment violation. That was incorrect. That's on page ER36. My second point regarding delay alone without prejudice, if there's any case law that supports that that's a improper, the Sanchez decision at page 177 to Sanchez discusses the United States versus Hamilton, a Ninth Circuit opinion, whereby the court found that revocation of probation after unreasonable delay under certain circumstances can be impermissible. And we have those circumstances here. We would submit at least genuine issues of material fact, given the circumstances, the unusual circumstances in this case, Ms. Cornell's belief, rightly or wrongly, that she had been discharged from parole, also her notification to the parole agency regarding her becoming homeless. I don't think someone should be punished for becoming homeless.
Counsel, I'm going to ask you the question that I asked your colleague. Are you aware of any case that finds a due process violation based on delay where there has not been prejudice to the parolee in terms of the parole proceedings?
I believe the discussion in Sanchez to United States versus Hamilton does provide an answer to the court. I do think there
there is sort of broad language in a couple of cases, but are you aware of a case where the facts of the case presented are such that the parolee had no prejudice and yet a violation was found?
I do not, Your Honor. I think there is prejudice here, though, given the disruption and in the most generic sense of the word prejudice, there was prejudice here. Lastly, on the state law claims, I think Your Honors could correct the fact that the United States Constitution says that reasonableness is the standard for arrest and searches and seizures. The Hawaii appellate courts have said also that reasonableness is the standard for arrest and search and seizures under Hawaii state law. But yet the lower court relied on the plaintiff having to show malice by clear and convincing
evidence. That's because the state law gives a qualified privilege. And I mean, these cases come up from time to time, and California law is very different than Hawaii law in this respect. So I think the state is allowed to give as much privilege as they want on a state law claim. You don't think they are?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think the United States Constitution creates a floor beneath which the state cannot go.
You're right as to the U.S. constitutional claims, but not as to state law claims. They can give whatever privilege they want as to state law claims.
Counsel?
Correct. You're right. The state appellate courts have never applied a conditional privilege to use of force in arrest situations. They've applied reasonableness, and we've cited authority for that.
Counsel, at the end of the day, isn't it correct that your client had the keys to the jailhouse door? First, by keeping the probation office aware of where she was and changes in that, and second, by accepting a prompt hearing on the merits.
I see your point, Your Honor. I think she should not have been put in the circumstances of having her parole suspended for 7 years and a warrant being delayed for that period of time. I could appreciate Your Honor's point I believe that under the circumstances, there were factual issues to what Your Honor is positing. Perhaps at the end of the day, after a trial on the merits, after full discovery, Your Honor's point could come to fruition. But I think that there were genuine issues of material fact below on these points, and I would submit to Your Honors that the lower court should not have granted summary judgment based on the record before it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments in this case, and the case is now submitted. We will move on to our final argument.